Warning. Today's episode focuses on the new film Joker, and to talk about this film, there will be spoilers. If you haven't seen the film yet, you may want to consider skipping this episode until you have. Thanks.
Hey, Sanj.
What's up, Doc? You know you have no case here. So if you're going to charge him, you bet him. Otherwise, you have to let him go.
Sanj, remember who this is you're talking to? That's Bigfoot Bjornsson, Renaissance cop.
I know he is. So, what's the beef here exactly?
It doesn't have much to do with your specialty, which I understand is marine law.
We got plenty of crime on the high seas, Lieutenant.
Okay, well, so far we have murder and kidnapping. We can work in pirates if it would make you more comfortable. Either way, it's high profile.
Yeah, but given your history of harassment with my client, this will never make it to trial.
No, I think we could probably take this all the way to trial, but with our luck, you know, the jury pool will be 99% hippie.
Unless you change the venue to maybe like Orange County, not as many hippies down there, you know?
Sasha, who are you working for?
Clients pay me for work, Doc. Clients pay me for work, Doc. So?
Well, I've decided I'm going to kick Mr. Sportello.
You know, kick him. That's assault.
I think it's police slang, Sasha. It means come me loose.
I'm gonna love you like no one's loved you.
Hello, and welcome back to Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim. And now, here he is, the federal government's whistleblower of the month, Teal. How's it going, buddy?
How's it going? Man, I've been blowing whistles like crazy.
Yeah, keeping yourself well hidden.
Sorry.
I'm hearing laughter, and it's not you, Teal. So what the hell's going on?
What's going on here? Do we have a guest?
I think you might.
I think we do.
We do. Introduce our guest.
Well, okay. She's jumped in. We have a special guest in the house today. Her name is, we're going to call her Sarah Bobara.
Sarah Bobara. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jim and Teal.
Today's episode is all about Joker. That's right. The Joker, the big film, all the controversy, everyone's talking about it. We figured we got to get in the act, but we felt that we alone can't get this job done, and we need to bring in a third party who can give her perspective on the film as well.
Yes.
I see.
Exactly. Yep, that's why you're here, for that third perspective.
All right, I am the third perspective. Yes, I am prepared to be that.
2 days ago, I was on a plane, and I was listening to our last episode, where we talked about my prejudging Joker.
Yes, you did prejudge it.
I totally
like a lot of America.
Like a lot of America, I totally prejudged Joker. I was upfront about the fact that I was prejudging it.
Yes, you were.
But
we all knew what you thought that was going to happen in that movie, and we knew that you were having trouble with the idea of maybe liking it.
I was having trouble with that, and it turns out that I did kind of like it.
Dun, dun,
dun. Did kind of like it.
So perhaps, you know, this should be a lesson to me about blah blah, judge a book by its cover, etc.
Okay, so that stage has been set. This is a film that, since it hit the festival circuit, has created a buzz, a lot of talk, a lot of controversy, and there was a lot of talk and controversy before the movie even came out. And then, of course, the movie has launched, and there's been even more controversies and discussions, and I think that's actually healthy, because we are in a world where movies don't get discussed like they used to, as far as, you know, a movie that can really spark debate and talk about bigger themes, what does it all mean, etc.
They're usually too terrible, I think, to have anything to talk about. I mean, the movies I've seen, I've walked out and been like, okay, yeah, that happened. This movie is the first movie I've seen in a very long time that I've been like, oh my gosh, I really need to talk to some people about this movie.
But I think that's kind of the case across the board. Even, you know, looking at reviews, the people who don't like it, there's still a lot for them to talk about. There's a few reviews that are like, the movie doesn't add up to much at all and there's nothing really to say. You know, of course, there's always a couple of those. Yeah. But for the most part, like it or not, people are engaging with the movie. It's made a ton of money. Yeah. People are going to see it. And it is starting these conversations around it. It's getting us talking about some things that we might not have been talking about in the same way before. So it is having an impact. It's changing the national conversation a little bit.
I'm surprised it is getting the national attention in a way that it is. I was surprised. To me, it's like an art house film. Like if it had been in French, nobody would see this film, in my opinion.
Wait, but then they would do an American remake that would be more like a Marvel film.
Yeah, well, yeah. It would be animated, like the Spider-Verse or something, yeah.
You know, I feel like this movie is very manipulative because the studio, I don't know what movie they thought they were going to be getting. I guarantee you it's a way different. And I feel like this is the whole overarching theme. It's kind of the joke's on you. And Todd Phillip is the Joker. He is having fun with the fact that he manipulated and gamed the Hollywood system, the regime of the DC Comics versus Marvel, and he put together a film that wasn't quite the origin story that I think the studio wanted, but yet when they watched it, they knew they were watching something that was beyond your typical comic book movie. And I think part of the marketing campaign was, well, how do we sell this movie? People are going to go opening weekend and they are going to rip the seats out because it's not not a goof fest.
Not just a goof fest, but I think some of that opening weekend is due to it being Halloween. Mm. It's October. People want to go see like It too and stuff. And I think some people went to this expecting kind of something a little more simple in its pleasures.
A movie like this does not play at the Venice Film Festival, and yet it does.
Right,
and
exactly.
So what they did was they let today's interviewers, the film critics, they let them take the bait. And oh, did they take the bait? They like weren't expecting like, oh, this comic book movie is going to be playing. And then that's what their expectations were.
Right.
And it was not what they thought it was going to be. And there were various reactions. And some people like totally felt like the movie was irresponsible and it somehow glorifies violence. And they wrote all sorts of crazy pieces. And then you had the other side saying, well, these wokester critics can't handle it. And it's created this maelstrom of debate before it could even open. And that to me is a genius marketing move. There's no other reason why you would put this film up other than the fact that I think there's a quality there, but that's not why they did it.
I agree with you that, yeah, that's what happened. That's why I saw it was because there was controversy. And the reason why I'm glad I saw it was because it was a really good film. And I do think there's this notion that it is somehow an inside joke. Like there's a part near the end of the film where he actually says, you know, you didn't get it. If this isn't funny to you, then you just didn't get it. But I do think that a lot of people who are seeing it because of the controversy would absolutely not see it if it was marketed how I would market it, as an awesome French film in English about a superhero.
What's your experience? You see it with people alone? How do you go see this?
I was on Facebook and Teal said that thing and I was like, okay, he's not going to tell me his opinion about this movie until I go see it. So I wanted to know Teal's opinion about the movie so badly that I went to see this movie by myself. There was one person who laughed in the theater besides me. Otherwise, you could feel the shrieking outrage in the theater.
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, it was not okay to laugh. We're at the theater I was in.
So were you just sitting there giggling away by yourself and everyone's uncomfortably looking at you?
I was sitting forward and in an aisle from everyone else, so I don't know if they were looking at me. I was shaking in my seat. I was laughing so hard at certain points. I felt worse, honestly, that I had a straw in my drink. I had to ask for a straw. Like, that's a new thing. I felt way worse that I actually had a straw and I was drinking a Coke, all of which is just so wrong. I walked out of the theater. And there's these couples sitting outside of the theater, basically getting everyone's opinion as they walk out of the theater. I'm, you know, midway because I have my straw and I'm embarrassed about the whole thing. So I wait for everybody else to get out so they don't see me. And they're like, so what did you think? I was like, I loved it. I thought it was great. They're like, well, you're in the minority. Everybody hated that Ooh. Film. They're like, don't see it. And blah, 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 blah. So
my experience, I went and saw it in 70 millimeter in Somerville, Massachusetts. I took my oldest son, who is 11, which is pretty young. When I was his age, I saw movies like this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Same.
It makes a lot of sense if you're going to show your kids more adult material to just do it at the house and not in the theater.
Right.
So you don't see that as much. But and it also depends on the kid. My kid, you know, I looked at this as an opportunity. Like I kind of talked to him about the controversies going on while we were on the drive to go to the movie. And then we talked about it afterwards. I told him, be prepared because we're going to talk right. about this because I want to make sure, you know, you're okay with the stuff that happens. So that's that setting. And of course, we went to a 4 o'clock show because I thought if we went to the night show,
right.
more people around us would be uncomfortable seeing an 11-year-old than necessarily he would.
Right, right, right.
There were a few people saying, what's this 11-year-old doing? You know, we go to see this movie and that sound made your hair stand on end. You felt yeah. it. And of course, it has a great, amazing score and a great sound design. And so you take the high resolution image matched up with this sound and it immerses you. And when it's in 1.85 image, and what I think that you guys probably saw the same thing too, is there's a lot of close-ups. You yes. really see the emotion and the acting in Joaquin Phoenix's face.
Yes.
Now you put the 70 millimeter resolution on top of that, and you know, it was so intense, especially as you got to the end, that it made you feel a lot of things. And I really... that level, just the experience, it was a wowzer, and it really was one of the best 70 millimeter presentations I've attended in many
wow.
years.
Wow.
Yeah, it was even better than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I love that, but this presentation, just because of the way the sound
right, right.
design was, it yeah. floored me.
Well, and it's the sound is really designed in a different way than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's really supposed to be this undercurrent of emotion and distress kind of through the whole film. And it's supposed to put you in a specific frame of mind.
How about your experience, Teal?
So I saw this. I was in Iowa for the weekend in a city called Iowa City.
I've been there.
You've been there?
I have.
Okay. Well, they have a brand new theater
Ooh.
Called Film Scene. It is a really cool place. It's in a building that's still under construction, but they had opened the theater. So it's really brand new.
Nice.
I think they'd been open a couple of weeks. And they're a nonprofit theater. And so they play all sorts of foreign films and art films and classics. And they have like a screening on a rooftop throughout the summer. So they do a lot of really interesting things. And it's a brand new theater. And before the movie, theater employee came out and introduced the film, which I thought was kind of cool.
Whoa.
Yeah. And he just said, okay, this is a great film. It won at Venice, et cetera, et cetera. And he also said that this is the most state-of-the-art theater in the state of Iowa.
Hmm.
And so I haven't dug around enough on their website yet to find out what the projection and sound was, but it is.
So he didn't give you the details. It's probably a 4K projector. It has to be.
It is the best digital projection I've ever seen. It was absolutely stunning, and the sound was stunning. And so I don't, it's at least 4K. It wouldn't surprise me if they were doing 8K though. They're also set up to play 35 millimeter there.
That's great because, you know, I mean, you and I both, we live in states where it's really hard to see a film like this. You know, if you're going to spend the money, it's not just, you want the experience and you want those things to make it even better, you know?
Absolutely. And so, it was a great presentation. I went with a friend of mine and, you know, we sat there in stunned amazement for most of the movie. And of course, like Sarah said, I giggled a little bit too.
Mm-hmm. I definitely had some laughs, and then I had a couple of uncomfortable laughs.
Yes.
you know?
Kind of like the main character having a few uncomfortable laughs.
Yeah, I wasn't laughing quite as much as Joaquin's character was, but...
So that was my experience, and yeah, it was a great presentation, the best theatrical presentation I've been in a long time, because I'm in, you know, small town, middle of nowhere multiplex.
Land. Yeah, and you have to take what you get. You know?
Yeah.
You know, for me, I'm able to go down. My family lives in Massachusetts. So, you know, if I have other things I'm doing there, it's not a big deal to be able to catch one of these things.
Yeah.
But obviously, if I didn't have that, I probably wouldn't see all these in the nice presentation.
I saw it in a multiplex. And I think I don't know. I kind of thought I was going to hate it because I wasn't sure, because Teal and I have disagreed on certain films. So the fact that Teal was sort of being silent on it was like, I might hate it and I might love it. So I was okay with the multiplex, and I was shocked at the sound design. I mean, there were probably only 200 seats in the whole theater. It was a pretty small place, but you could definitely hear, you know, when the sound was behind you or going around you. It was awesome.
That is cool. Yeah. And there's some, and it's interesting for a movie that is so small in scale in a way. So many scenes are just in, you know, small room. I mean, yeah, there's exteriors and stuff, but it's not a massive scale. There's not a lot of big action scenes or car chases or things where you would expect that kind of sound design.
It's kind of claustrophobic, almost.
Very claustrophobic, yes.
And so, it feels cool like that, the way it's all kind of zoomed in.
Well, that's those close-ups that Jim was talking about, where you really get to see. I mean, what an amazing amount of work he did on his facial muscles for this movie. I mean, like, I feel like he changed the way his face works for this
movie.
Well,
that's one of the reasons why I think he lost the 50 pounds.
Right, right.
Is when you lose that, your skin gets loose, and it allowed him to express himself differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I feel like this is, we're getting into performance now, but it's such a deep performance because it's so rooted in the physicality of it. You know, there's something weird going on with his left shoulder. Mm. It's like almost dislocated, and his shoulder blades kind of stick out, his ribs stick out, and then he's got these, you know, his dance moves. And there's one point in the movie at which where it really just struck me while I was watching it, where he steals the file and runs down the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And the way in which he runs is so specific to that character and so physical that this is a performance that's like in his body, and as opposed to just in his voice. It's very rare that you see somebody put this kind of physicality into a performance at that level, you know, the way that, like, say, Charlie Chaplin would, or Buster Keaton.
I don't know whether we'll see when it comes to award season. I'm sure he'll be in the conversation, but I think this is a performance that we'll be talking about for years and years after any accolades, you know, awards, because it is such a multi-layered performance.
Yes.
I also think you're mentioning Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin is not out of the blue. I mean, Chaplin film is playing. I think the whole slapstick physical comedy of it. I mean, I had read that it wasn't funny at all. And then he's dressed as a clown and he kind of overreaches and acts alley when he's running and he kind of has to slide backwards with his hand on the ground. I mean, from that second on, I was like, oh, right. I know what world we're in. We're in the slapstick comedy world. So by the time we got to the actual silent films playing and Charlie Chaplin, he was amazing.
Yeah, just jaw-dropping, stunning performance.
Yeah, worth seeing really, for that.
Yeah, it's the only equal I can find for this performance is Joaquin Phoenix in The Master.
I haven't seen that.
Okay.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. It's probably the two like greatest like tête-à-tête performances between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix.
I thought of Philip Seymour Hoffman when I was watching Joaquin Phoenix. I was like, you know, the only other performance I've seen like this was Philip Seymour Hoffman in Capote. I kept thinking about Capote and his voice in that. So I'm amazed that Joaquin Phoenix was in a film opposite Philip Seymour Hoffman. I really want to see that. It's called The Master.
Yeah, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
You got to see it.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, it is intense. And there's something a little bit off-putting about it.
I imagine. Yeah. As well there should be. Yes, that sounds great.
This is my whole take on the film. This movie isn't even a comic book movie at all. And that it's a commentary on the comic book culture that has seeped into society. And this, you know, it's everywhere. And all the movies and Hollywood is obsessed with it. And this is why I thought that Todd Phillips and them put one over on Warner Brothers. They thought they were getting an origin story, and you could take it as an origin story, a very dark one. But the end of this movie calls everything into question. And now you have to be, as a viewer of the film, you have to kind of think about it and kind of interpret your own way. So I have two interpretations of the film.
Okay.
And one is this, and this is probably the most radical one. Obviously, he's an unreliable narrator. At the very end, it's completely different. The cinematography, the aesthetic, and the psychiatrist is the same actress as a social worker, but she's a psychiatrist. It's completely different. Not just as we've been unveiled, there's certain things that obviously didn't happen. They only happen in his imagination.
The girlfriend. Yeah.
That you have to put into question everything that has happened from the time the credits rolled at the beginning up until that moment. And one take I have is that there was no Joker. This is in his head, but at the end, you know, this is a character he's created because he had a terrible childhood. He had trauma, and maybe the events we saw, clearly 1981 plays a role in this guy's brain, and perhaps he was this little boy, kind of like the Bruce Wayne, and he thinks of himself as a guy who was abandoned by his father, never knew him, thought he may have been somebody, he fantasized that he could have been this rich millionaire, and that the end of the movie takes place in the real world. And all of these events and the stuff, we don't know what really happened or didn't happen. Maybe some things happened a certain way. I have a suspicion some did. And at the end,
you're kind of going with the extreme unreliable narrator. Like, we can't trust anything we see. All of this could be sort of like Usual Suspects, right? Where it's all an invention of Kaiser Soze or whoever.
Yes. When he goes down the hallway, you see the bloody footprints, and then you see him being chased, right?
Yeah.
What does it close with? And this is something I don't know why. I think that a lot of people don't know their film history or something. It closes with the titles of The End. And the font used is the same font that The Wizard of Oz ends with. That's like a great tell that some of this is a dream. And of course, if you read the books, there was the early 80s movie Return to Oz. The start of that film is that nobody believed Dorothy. They thought she was having a schizophrenic episode.
Right.
And she gets shock therapy. And here we find this character, Arthur Fleck, who was never mentioned in the comics. There's no Arthur Fleck in the comics. So he's a regular person. And to me, that's very obvious. But here's the second possibility that I will allow for, that this journey and whatever really happened to this guy, at the very end, he does become what he's fantasized about. He becomes the Joker when he runs down that hallway.
Right.
And if he escapes and say this was tied to a real Gotham City,
yeah,
that perhaps it's now the real world and they can set it up and use him as a foe for the Batman movie that they're going to be creating.
Interesting. Okay, so I guess, man, okay, so I'm going to go back to my experience of the movie for a minute. While I was watching the movie, I realized that I was approaching it very clinically in terms of my approach to the character, but also my approach to the script and the filmmaking. So I had these little frustrations throughout, like when the girlfriend storyline is revealed to have been his delusion. That made me question everything the way you're talking about, but I didn't like questioning all those things. And then when I got to the end, I had similar questions, like what's in his head? Has he been, you know, yes, that actress is the same as the whole thing taking place in this office. And it's all just, in, you know, I had some of those questions and those doubts. And then I walked out of the movie and I realized that I was having this, again, very clinical response to it.
As opposed to emotional, you're saying?
Exactly. As opposed to emotional, I was looking at it very intellectual. Uh-huh. And so I was sort of holding the film at a distance while I was watching it. And it took me, so I immediately thought, I need to see it again. Like something didn't quite click here. And it was over the following 2 days that I realized what was going on with me is that I have mental illness issues. And so I almost couldn't let myself totally empathize with the character. I had to hold it at a distance because it was almost too close to home. And almost too easy to relate to. And so I did hold it at a distance. And then once I realized that, I was able to see, to think about the film in a whole new way and to bring in all these other questions that we're talking about and sort of not feel threatened by them. And there's something very uncomfortable about watching somebody deal with mental illness. And, you know, he's got mental illness and he's got a disability. Yeah, so once I realized, okay, I don't need to see it again immediately. I didn't like have to run right out because I understood what my response had been. Uh-huh. And so a lot of the controversy about this movie has been, or some of the controversy has been about mental illness and the treatment of mental illness. And is it glorifying it? Is it associating violence with mental illness? Is there a correlation between, like, does a disability make you a villain? I've read reviews that say he's a villain because he has a disability. Yeah. And it's stigmatizing. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And so there's all these sort of, I don't know, maybe identity politics is the right term for it, but ways of looking at it in terms of the social commentary, in terms of race and violence and lone gunmen kind of things and vigilantism and the 1% and all of these things. And what I came away with was that it's not... I kept thinking about stigmatizing versus empathy and how we feel about this character. Is he, are we looking at him as an icon of mental illness, as like a caricature of it, or as an individual who has their own individual struggles and sufferings that aren't speaking for everyone with mental illness? They're just speaking for this character. And that's ultimately where I came to. This is such a specific character. Yes, it's dealing with things like childhood trauma and disabilities and mental illness, but it's not diagnostic in that sense. And so I came away with it as thinking that the movie is almost a Rorschach test, right, on all of these issues. And that in a way, what you think about the movie says more about you than the movie.
Yes.
Well, that's an interesting take.
I feel like that's true of every movie, though. I mean, you can say that about anything. But this movie, feel like in particular, I felt like I had to suspend judgment about some big topics like feminism and mental health, you know? Yeah. I was like, okay, is this movie going to offend me on any of my hot button issues? And in the end, it felt like the movie was so good and so highly controlled, and everything in the movie was done for a very particular reason that I gave up trying to be in control, I think, of like my own reaction to the movie. I just sort of went into the world and trusted. And I don't feel that that trust was unfounded. I didn't feel in the end like it offended me at all.
Before I watched it, I was expecting to be offended.
Right.
And the fact that I wasn't offended really at all, I think, speaks to how good the film is. And in terms of, I guess what I'll go back to is I feel like the film is asking us questions more than it's providing us with answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing is I think it doesn't set out to provide answers, and it does. It presents a story. And again, I have a particular take that changes everything that I watched at the beginning. But like for the violence, for instance, right? I think that the violence, which is very extreme, it's unsettling.
But there's very little of it.
The scenes that happen, they're very intense.
Yes.
But I think it's purposeful because it's saying that we worship these supervillains and we want to see like, you know, crazy action and almost irresponsible violence. And now we have tricked you into watching this thing about a guy who's going to turn into the Joker and do all these bad things. But, oh, wait a minute. The things he does, in his mind, he may be justified, however crazy that sounds.
Yeah.
But when we watched them, now Todd Phillips, I got to give this guy some credit. He's putting us, the viewer, right in the hot seat and says, okay, can you now go along with this guy? Can you worship this guy?
Exactly.
It's really hard. And I like didn't think that this guy, Todd Phillips, could ever make a movie like this.
Well, and we've talked about this. I think I've brought this up on the show before, this idea of strong violence versus weak violence. Have I talked about this before?
Refresh me.
Okay. Basically what it comes down to.
I like it.
Is weak violence is like, say, Hobbs and Shaw.
Yes.
Right. Your typical sort of summer blockbuster action shoot 'em up is weak violence because we can kind of, as audience members, shrug it off.
Yeah, it's like John Wick. It's extreme weak violence.
Yes, it's extreme weak violence, but it's essentially gratuitous.
Yes.
Whereas strong violence is violence that morally implicates the audience in one way or another. That actually asks us those questions of, you know, do we support this kind of violence? How do we feel about revenge? What does revenge do to the person? What is, you know, acting out in these violent ways, what is the impact of that? And so in a way, strong violence has consequence and moral consequence and moral weight. And I feel like what you're talking about, Jim, is exactly that. When we see these violent acts, are we going with him on this? How much does our sympathy for his suffering, how much of that can be translated into advocating for violence? And how much do we see him as a victim? How much of it is defensive? How much of it is offensive? And where do we draw these lines? And I feel like the movie does not draw those lines really clearly for us. It sort of lays out the pieces and asks us where we're going to draw them. And that's what I mean by the movie being a Rorschach test, right? Is that there's no real, like we never, I guess we find out that he was adopted. We sort of get facts, but everything is amorphous in a way. We're dealing with his perceptions of things and what he thinks of them, and we're dealing with an unreliable narrator. And so what we decide to attach to as real in the film, I think, like I said, it says more about us. It says a lot about us.
I guess in my sense, I like the fact that the facts weren't completely clear. That felt very realistic to me. So when I felt that when it came off to me as true, I mean, there's no way you can look at this movie as true because of the way that it's shot, like the way we were talking about the close-ups and zooming in and how it's very claustrophobic. And then if you look at the way the buildings are, the background is always very comic book. And then there's kind of this lighter spot in the middle of the shot where the action is happening. So it felt to me like the violence was comic book, like over the top, like Lone Wolf and Cub, slasher kind of bloody violence. And This Is America. That's what it reminded me of. Like everything's going along fine. And then, which is how real violence feels when it actually happens to you is everything's going along fine, and then plow, there's this event. So I felt like, given all of the tech they had to work with and the film and the storyline, I felt like they did a really good job of showing this person's suffering.
I think that's what it really comes down to. It's just a portrait of a character who's suffering, and it asks us, how do we as a society, deal with people like this?
Right. Who's to blame? You know, is someone to blame? And if if you can't point blame, then what do you do with this monster that you've all created?
Yes, because he is, I think, shown as sort of a natural outgrowth of the conflict and pain in society.
Yeah, he's a monster, but he wasn't born that way. You know, he's not from Krypton. He's not from a different planet. He's basically been through a bunch of gnarly stuff that basically, I think, is the kind of stuff that turns humans into criminals in the real world. That kind of mental illness plus a neglect, plus then he can't get his medication because of...
Yes.
I mean, these are things that
budget cuts.
They happen to... they are happening right now to people that we know who are struggling to not be monsters. No one wants... Yes. This guy doesn't want to be a monster at all. He just wants to be safe and loved like everybody else. But he can't do that because he's like Frankenstein. He's awesomely like Frankenstein. And like Lenny from... Of Mice and Men, there's this character who's just like so big and doesn't know his own strength, but he just is looking for love and ends up hurting people. I mean, this guy is more extreme, obviously.
Right. But that's but you're right. It ultimately is about acceptance and love and empathy. And that's and the world simply is not providing that in any way.
He can't get it anywhere. His dad left. His mom is a freaking basket case who may or may not have let another man abuse him. I mean, I'm going to say she did. I'm going to say that happens.
Yeah.
I'm going to say she has really bad boundaries. She's like naked in the bathtub and he's in the bathroom. I'm like, ooh, she's bad news. And I love that about it. And I love that he finally realizes that she's bad news and there's nothing he can do about his past. But he's going to kill her because he figured out that she was abusive to him his entire life. So I liked that. I thought it was cool.
And she, that's one of the moments at which you were giggling in the theater when he smothers his mother.
Probably. Yeah. I know. Probably when he's like all happy about it. You know, I was like, yeah, I get that. You're free. Dance around. And no one else in the world will understand that having understood this and then taken care of the problem forever, you can now dance around and be free. And it's super sad. It's very, very sad. There's nothing happy about it. Yet, you are free. And that is a happy thing.
I believe, in the end, this character, played by Joaquin Phoenix, this is the story he wants you to believe, the audience. He wants you to feel the sympathy. And I will not state that I even know exactly what happened to this guy. This is how I look back. Because we always have to like say, okay, well, what do we think really happened? So in my imagination, I believe that the film actually takes place present day.
Right.
And yet it's set in 1981. We got this great Warner Brothers early 80s, late 70s logo that comes on the screen. And that was really cool. But this movie is a constant blending of things that were happening at that time, which if he was a kid in the early 80s, he might remember and put it into his narrative. So, you know, New York City was very violent.
Yeah.
I look at the Gotham City as his sort of substitute for New York City. Everything that's happening that we're seeing is really New York City. There was garbage strikes.
Right.
So that accounts for that. You know, you had a lot of violence. And then in 1984, you had the Bernie Goetz subway incident.
So that was on my mind through the entire movie, was Bernard Goetz.
So this is what I thought was very interesting, because there's been a lot of talk about this part is the fact of, oh, there's a lot of Taxi Driver references and King of Comedy references. And yes, there are. It's very similar to the degree that you've got the finger pointing like a gun to the head, which was right from Taxi Driver. And of course, a lot of people probably haven't seen King of Comedy, but it is not mistakable that we've got the talk show host played by Robert De Niro. And in King of Comedy, he played basically a version of Joaquin Phoenix's character. He played Rupert Pupkin, who was obsessed with a talk show host.
Exactly. So,
such a good movie.
This is where he is taking whatever happened in his own real life. He has mixed it in with these pop culture moments that maybe he identified with. And even Robert De Niro makes a joke on like the fake show that's almost identical to a Rupert Pupkin joke.
Right.
And the thing is, so ask yourself this question. Why hire Robert De Niro to be in this movie? You do it because it's important for Robert De Niro to be in this film, because his character imagines in his world a guy who's like Robert De Niro. And you got to have Robert De Niro play that character. Otherwise, I don't think that Robert De Niro would have been interested in the role. The mixture of this 1981 setting and where is present day reality and where it gets blended is that when he goes and does his supposed stand up performance.
Yeah, I'm with you on this.
His not real girlfriend is in the audience. So that means that didn't happen. And nobody's videotaping his performance and sending it to the talk show host. That's something that in his mind he would have loved. So that couldn't have happened.
It's something that would happen now. It's
yes,
a social,
exactly.
It's basically, he goes viral.
He does.
In a time when you couldn't go viral.
I don't know what may have really happened, but that's why I love this layer. He is telling us a story, or he's telling this psychiatrist a story.
In the analogy to our time, if we look at our world as being sort of like this world of Gotham, and then we put next to that our obsession with superhero, right? And why in this particular time and place are we so obsessed culturally with these heroes who are, you know, like Spider-Man is a Boy Scout, really. You know, he is like a perfect kind of guy. And you know, and then you have Tony Stark, who, yes, maybe he drinks a little too much, but only in the first movie. Right. And yes, maybe Tony Stark has some PTSD in Iron Man 3, and they're trying to sort of pay a little lip service to some issues to try to make the films a little more serious. But they're fantasies. And this is a movie that's saying, is this a fantasy?
In a way, this was sort of our everyman. Right now, he's kind of the everyman American, not great parents going on, mental illness, neglect. There's zero social services. It's not like he can get a job. And he's kind of gender different. Like, he's not a manly man. So I feel like this is a smart movie in that it's seen all the other movies. It's definitely seen all the silent films. It's seen Silence of the Lambs. It's seen all of Scorsese, for sure. But silent film, I feel like, plays a huge, huge part in this.
Yes.
So that's my point.
Well, in that, I think, goes back to sort of the physicality of his performance and how this could be a silent film performance.
It could. Like, I loved how careful they were with the entire mise-en-scene, the entire screen, up to down, side to side, the sound design. I felt like this director was thoughtful, was a control freak, had everything in hand. The only time I felt that the director had jumped for me, I didn't quite trust that jump, was when he started dancing a lot.
Oh.
That one scene where he just starts really dancing. I'm like, I didn't know he could dance that well. That seems weird.
Okay, that's interesting. I just went with it sort of as like an emotional thing. Mm. The dancing was purely emotional.
You know, here's a guy at the beginning of the movie, right? He's happy. He's a happy clown.
He's doing something
and he's dancing. He's just making people like he's enjoying himself. And then he gets the shit kicked out of him. And of course, unlike most movies where you're forgetting about that the next day, he wears the physical pains and not just the emotional scars from that. It's so great that you see those bruises, you see how he's injured and walking, and he's not happy anymore, and he hasn't been. And not until he starts climbing mentally to that space where he is now sort of in that ultimate manic mode, and when he's, you know, actually makes the decision to kill, suddenly there's a release and he sees what he needs to become, and then he's happy again. So he's dancing because now he can really be this character that he wants to be and he's been sort of imagining.
Part of the reason the dancing is so important is that it's a counterpoint to the violence, right? If he just became violent, the character wouldn't have the same kind of depth, right? If his freedom is solely about violence, but it's not. His freedom is also about joy. And he basically, I mean, it's a very complex thing. He sort of becomes free because he's unmedicated, but that's also dangerous and he really needs to be medicated. But to me, it's not giving any easy answers to those. And Sarah, something you had said about the everyman, 20% of Americans have some form of mental illness.
Yeah.
Right. And so that means a lot of people know somebody who does. And so it's not just these. We have this, I think, in fact, there's stigmatizing going on in the media about these shootings and stuff. And, oh, we need to look at mental illness and have red flag laws. And which wouldn't have worked in this movie because he doesn't buy a gun. Somebody just hands him one.
Yeah. I mean, that character is interesting because he and the actor's name is Glenn Fleshier, and he plays Randall, which is very similar in Taxi Driver to Peter Boyle's Brain character.
Very similar, yeah.
And yeah, you know, that's a key, right? So we know, like, Joaquin Phoenix's character Arthur knows that he's mentally unwell, but he knows enough not to go out and buy a gun.
Exactly. Yeah.
But he doesn't know enough not to bring it to the hospital where he's going to perform for kids.
Well, but he's terrified. So he's taking it with him everywhere. This is exactly what happened to Bernard Goetz.
Exactly.
He got beat up. He went and got a gun. He was terrified and paranoid. And so when some guys came up and started hassling him on the subway, he shot them because he was in basically a post-traumatic state. And I think that's Arthur has a whole host of mental illness problems. You know, I don't want to get too diagnostic with him. So another thing I wanted to point out, we're sort of talking about what's real and what isn't real. I think an important moment for the movie for me is that it is not Arthur who kills the Waynes. It's somebody else. And I am thinking about how this fits into Jim's theory and my theory and how that affects the issue of personal responsibility and societal unacceptance. And is this a movement or an individual? And where do you draw those lines? And at what point is the line between sort of vigilantism and murder drawn? Because Batman is also a vigilante. I think that needs to be pointed out, right? Batman is a violent vigilante. Again, my take on it is this movie is asking us to think about those things. And it's not telling us an answer to them. It's not a polemic.
Agreed.
It's a question. It's a Rorschach test. So that's my take on Joker. And I loved it.
Now you loved it. You said you sort of liked it at the beginning, but now you love it.
Well, I wanted to hold back on how I really felt because I feel like it's complicated. There's a lot of complicated things going on. And it's hard to just unabashedly say I loved it because
as a normal story, if you just follow the normal rules of watching the movie, I had a good time. But because it's so much more.
Yes.
It's like an after effect. Like, I didn't walk out of the movie going, yeah, Joker. I was wowed by what I saw. And over time, really started to think a lot about it and the meanings and formulating my own thoughts, etc. Yeah. And that's when I love a movie, when it's giving me a lot more to think about and theorize on, whether or not, you know, people agree with some of the things that I think, or that it's just, even if you can get any movie that is going to give you any more than one interpretation of a film, you got something.
Well, and here's what's amazing is I think we all really, all three of us really liked this film, and we all have different reasons for really liking it.
Anchoring it is that an undeniable, like, amazing performance by the central character played by Joaquin Phoenix. That's, and, you know, you get that performance.
I agree about the performance is also awesome, but good performers can look terrible if the direction isn't keeping the world cohesive and coherent. And that world was so tight. I mean, that's how I felt leaving the movie. I felt like, okay, I don't like what happens in Barry Lyndon. I don't really like the story of Barry Lyndon. But as a film, there is no denying that is an awesome, tight, well-made film. And that was how I left this movie. I felt like, okay, there's a lot going on. I don't pretend to know really anything. But that was a tight, well-made film.
It really is. Yeah. And I hope we will see it come up around award season.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you know you're in the hands of somebody who's not just some hack is the fact that they chose to shoot the film 1.85, not super widescreen, which your character can get lost in. And so many directors just say, oh, but, you know, it's wider. And they don't look
everything
at the advantages.
Was a choice. A smart, smart, well-educated. These guys have seen everything. And I want to talk to them about what they thought of other films. Like, this felt to me a little French New Wave and, you know, the Hollywood era of whatever that golden era of Hollywood. Like, I felt like this person was a filmmaker's filmmaker, which is also could be said of Scorsese. You know, we love watching his movies because he's using all of the tricks and toys you get to use when you make a film. It's got a lot of depth. That's what I felt like with this film. I felt like, oh, this director's using everything. And I love that. I
wanted to thank our guest today, Sarah from Oregon. And of course, Teal, appreciate you coming on in as well. This is all for this episode. But if you like what you heard, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And don't forget to leave a rating. Always appreciated. And don't forget to go see some stuff. Thanks.
Bye-bye.